From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it's been another busy day for President Trump on his second full weekday in office. Trump signed executive actions that would advance the construction of two pipelines stopped by the Obama administration, the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline.
We're going to renegotiate some of the terms, and if they'd like, we'll see if we can get that pipeline built. A lot of jobs, 28,000 jobs.
He said he'd name a Supreme Court nominee next week, and going into a meeting with the heads of U.S. car companies, Trump spoke about rolling back environmental regulations.
I mean, I have friends that want to build in the United States. They go many, many years, and then they can't get their environmental permit over something that nobody ever heard of before. And it's absolutely crazy. And I am, to a large extent, an environmentalist. I believe in it. But it's out of control.
Lots to talk about with Domenico Montanaro, NPR Politics editor. And Domenico, let's start with the news today about a Supreme Court nominee coming next week. Who's in the running? Do we know?
Well, you know, you might remember that back during the campaign, Donald Trump put out a list of some nominees. He later put out a secondary list that was a bit more diverse because it was criticized early on that it wasn't that that diverse. There are some folks from various benches. There are some names that have been floated. People like Keith Blackwell, Charles Kennedy, Neil Gorsuch, Mike Lee, the senator, Edward Mansfield. There are a whole list of names that we have on our website and we'll be looking at even more, but definitely conservatives.
Conservative people that would be replacing Antonin Scalia, and that seat has been vacant now for quite some time. What about the executive actions that we talked about that Trump signed today involving these pipelines? What do they accomplish?
Well, the pipeline projects do two things for Trump because this is all about energy and he can talk about energy jobs, but also about infrastructure. And that's, we know, a pet project, an idea of his counselor, Steve Bannon, in the White House, who believes that if Trump can get a big infrastructure bill through, that that will help his popularity.
It's been reported that Trump will keep James Comey as FBI director. Do we know more about that? And of course, you know, we remember Comey was very much criticized for statements he made before the election about Hillary Clinton's emails.
Yeah, it's not surprising to me. This would do a couple things. It would smooth the transition. And even though Trump was critical of the FBI for not going after Hillary Clinton more strongly, remember Trump himself said that he doesn't think Hillary Clinton should face prosecution once he won. And Reince Priebus, Trump's chief of staff, was on ABC's This Week earlier this month and said that they have confidence in James Comey and that there are no plans to replace him.
Domenico, last night, Trump had dinner with a lot of the congressional leadership, and he apparently said something there, again, repeated this idea that millions of undocumented immigrants had illegally voted in the election. Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, said he sees no evidence of that. But what do you make of this and why Trump keeps saying this thing, which is not true?
Yeah. And Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, was also talking about this today and said that he thinks Trump undermines himself when he continues to talk about this. Like you said, there is no evidence of this. But it does speak to the fact that Trump continues to be obsessed with issues of his legitimacy.
He's got a lot of nominees on Capitol Hill taking questions from senators to be confirmed. Do you think that any of them at this point look like they might not be confirmed, or are the senators likely to say yes to all of Trump's nominees?
They should all likely sail through. This is largely because Democrats changed the rules in 2013, meaning anything that is not a Supreme Court nominee or legislation is not subject to the 60-vote threshold to move a nominee to the floor. So they all just need a majority vote. They've got a majority of Republicans. Rex Tillerson, for example, seemed to be the one that maybe some Republicans would back away from. But we had Marco Rubio, John McCain both say that they would vote for him.
Trump signed an executive order yesterday implementing a federal hiring freeze. Gosh, there is a lot going on in these first few days. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of that?
Well, the military and security outfits are going to be exempt from that. So you'll likely see the military grow and the rest of the government shrink by attrition. So he had promised if people retire, he won't hire for those jobs. This has been a promise during his campaign, and he's likely to follow through on it here.
One more thing, Domenico. We heard today that House Speaker Paul Ryan has invited Trump to speak to a joint session of Congress on February 28th. Now, this is typical, right, of new presidents. They get invited by the Congress to come and speak to a joint session. What are you expecting?
This is usually like the State of the Union. So Donald Trump has been saying we have to make America great again, that there's significant, quote, carnage in the country when it comes to jobs. But what State of the Unions do that's different than inaugural addresses are supposed to be hopeful, forward-looking, inspirational in some ways. Trump's was more dark, but also laying out a framework for how he views the country. The State of the Union type address, this is the joint congressional address to Congress, right, not a State of the Union. He should lay out some specific policy agenda items of what his priorities are going forward.
And we'll be watching to see what happens on February 28th, but of course, a lot more before then. Domenico Montanaro, NPR Politics Editor, thanks.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well, earlier this month, it was big news when Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus announced it will fold up the Big Top in May after 146 years and after ticket sales declined when the circus stopped using elephants in its acts. More than 460 employees will lose their jobs. But in Brattleboro, Vermont, the New England Center for Circus Arts will continue training aspiring circus performers. The staff says their future has never been brighter. Howard Weiss Tisman from Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio has more.
Good. Better on the up, Miranda. Still a little low.
Pretty low. Yeah.
Yep. Do it again.
It's Monday morning at the New England Center for Circus Arts, or NECA, and graduates of the program are taking advantage of the open studio. NECA is a training school for professional circus artists, and co-founder Elsie Smith is working with two aerialists who are practicing a flip high up on a single trapeze.
My hands feel so much better today. Two full days off. And
Smith co-founded NECA 9 years ago with her twin sister, Serenity. They've both performed with Ringling Brothers, and a number of the center's graduates have gone on to work with The Greatest Show on Earth.
Personally, I was surprised that they decided to close the entire circus portion of Feld Entertainment, so the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. I had been speaking with many people leading up to this about the idea that they were going to combine some of the different tours that they have, they're called units, into one tour. So I was surprised that they decided to call the entire thing quits.
The producers of Ringling Brothers announced earlier this month that the touring three-ring circus would give its last show in May due to high operating costs and declining ticket sales. The circus stopped using elephants in its show last May, and that's cited in part for the declining ticket sales. About 500 people work for the two traveling shows. Doug Stewart is a graduate of the New England Center for Circus Arts. He says, for many people, Ringling Brothers was their first experience with the circus, and he wonders what the impact might be on getting younger performers involved in the art.
Like, it was the first circus that I went to as a kid, and it's for a lot of people, Ringling is what people think of when you think of circus for the people that don't know what circus is. Like, you ask a circus artist, they think of Cirque du Soleil and the Seven Fingers, but you ask a random person off the street and they have images of Ringling Brothers, and it's sad that that image and that mentality of what circus is no longer going to be here.
Stewart auditioned for a spot with Ringling Brothers this summer, and he was put on a waiting list. So that won't be happening, but Stewart sees other opportunities out there.
As far as my dreams, I started my own company. There's a lot of smaller companies that are forming now, and I think the future of circus that I see is a lot more smaller companies and theaters as opposed to the traditional style and tents.
Some people will say that you want to make sure that they're flipped the opposite direction so that they can't unlock, because it only unlocks in one direction, mm-hmm. this way. Mm-hmm.
The New England Center for Circus Arts is busy this morning. There's a guy spinning inside an enormous wheel. A woman is practicing graceful moves on a rope that hangs from the ceiling. And a small group of performers spot each other as they try acrobatic moves across a padded floor. The performers are strong and confident. Their work is rooted in the centuries-old tradition of circus arts, but their movements speak to a contemporary art form.
In America, the circus school, the training, the artistic playing of circus mixed with theater, circus mixed with dance, circus as a contemporary voice is still very, very strong.
Elsie Smith says it's sad to see a venerable institution like Ringling Brothers fold up its tent, but there's another part to the story.
Circus arts in America is changing, and this just really puts a public title to everyone out there that circus is changing. We've been aware of it for a long time, those of us who are on the inside, and it's going to be a journey for us to try to remind the American public that we're still here and we're still alive and we're still doing really well. It's just a different art form.
The New England Center for Circus Arts started in an incubator warehouse space in 2003. Today, work is now underway to build a $2.5 million training center for circus arts. Future graduates won't be able to work with Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus, or with the Big Apple Circus, which also closed recently. But Smith says today's circus performers have a new show to create. For Here and Now, I'm Howard Weiss-Tisman, reporting from Brattleboro, Vermont.
President Trump's health secretary picked Tom Price, the Republican congressman from Georgia, is being questioned by a second Senate committee in his confirmation process. He's a longtime opponent of the Affordable Care Act. And today, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, grilled Price on President Trump's executive order that vaguely instructs agencies to start rolling back Obamacare.
Yes or no, under the executive order, will you commit that no one will be worse off?
What I commit to, Senator, is working with you and every single member of Congress to make certain that we have the highest quality health care and that every single American has access to affordable coverage.
That is not what I asked. I asked, will you commit that no one will be worse off under the executive order? You ducked the question. Will you guarantee that no one will lose coverage under the executive order?
I guarantee you that the individuals that lost coverage under the Affordable Care Act, we will commit to making certain that they don't lose coverage under whatever replacement plan comes forward. That's the commitment that I provide.
Meanwhile, GOP lawmakers are focusing on how to repeal and replace the health care law. They plan to meet for more brainstorming starting tomorrow in Philadelphia. Let's check in with Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, start with Tom Price. Equivocating there? What did you hear?
Yeah, he equivocated on a lot of answers. He was very careful in choosing his words, although I think the one that got sort of the biggest laugh was Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio asked him about what the president told the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago, which is that he and Price were working on a plan and that it was almost finished. And Senator Brown asked if that was true. And Tom Price responded, yes, it's true that he said that, rather than actually answering the question about the status of the health plan.
So it must be hearings time. But what do you think about Tom Price? Do you think he'll be confirmed?
Today's hearing, which is the Senate Finance Committee, is the committee that votes on him. And there would have to be at least one Republican who would say that they did not want to vote for him for the nomination not to move forward. And when I walked away a few minutes ago, there had not been a single Republican who did not seem to be supporting him. So the Democrats are very upset about some of his stock trades and potential interference, you know, trying to do favors for companies that either own stock in or that had given him campaign contributions. But the Republicans, that does not seem to bother them.
Well, and what about the executive order from Donald Trump to these agencies? Robert Lazuski, who was president of the consulting firm Health Policy and Strategy Associates, told the Washington Post it was like throwing a bomb into an already shaky insurance market. Why? What are the agencies doing?
Well, it's interesting that the executive order that the president signed on Friday night basically doesn't give the agency any authority that it didn't already have to try to slow walk or change regulations or otherwise undermine the workings of the Affordable Care Act. It was kind of an exhortation, if you will, to say you should go and do that. There were a lot of questions for, prospective Secretary Price today about what he would do under that executive order, most of which he kind of didn't answer. Mm-hmm. I think what Bob Leshefsky was talking about is that it throws more uncertainty into the future of the law and whether there actually will be a replacement, whether they might repeal it first and do a replacement later, which could, in fact, throw the insurance market into chaos. So even though the executive order doesn't have a lot of practical impact, it did kind of freak a lot of people out.
Yeah. We'll talk about some of the other aspects. Medicaid for the very poor, as opposed to Medicare for those over 65 or with a severe disability. Remind us how Obamacare expanded Medicaid. You know, some states opted out. and how Trump wants to end the current Medicaid program?
Well, basically, as you pointed out, Medicaid has always been a categorical program. You had to either be poor and something, either poor and a child or poor and usually a mother, poor and disabled or poor and elderly. What the Affordable Care Act did was that it said all you had to be was poor. If you had income under 133% of poverty, you could qualify for Medicaid. But because of a Supreme Court decision in 2012, that expansion became optional. And so far, 31 states have expanded. The federal government pays the vast majority of those funds. I think this year it's down to 95%. So it's a great deal for states to get a lot of people covered, and a lot of people have been covered. What Republicans in Congress, not so much President Trump, although I think he may be going along with them, want to do is block grant Medicaid and say it's no longer an open-ended entitlement. We're going to turn it back to the states. We're going to say you can do whatever you want, but you're only going to get this amount of money. And most estimates say that it could end up cutting funding for a lot of states by up to a third.
Well, and so where are we on some of the replacement ideas? We know that Obamacare works according to its supporters because everyone's required by that mandate to purchase some sort of insurance, and the healthier subsidize the less healthy, and that enables insurers to cover people with previous conditions, for instance. What is the sense of going forward? Will the mandate go away? Will the previous conditions prerequisite go away? What's the sense of what Republicans are thinking?
Well, Republicans, you know, it's not that Republicans don't have replace ideas. It's the problem is they have too many replace ideas. They have lots of different ideas and none of them necessarily go together. There has been no consensus. The only thing that there was a consensus on is that they want to make the Affordable Care Act go away. That's one of the things this retreat in Philadelphia is supposed to start to work out. The vice president is coming. The president is coming. So there will be a lot of closed door discussions with House and Senate Republicans. And, you know, the hope is that they can all get on the same page.
Have you, you got a few seconds here, have you been hearing any whispers that this might not work?
I think the people who've been, you know, even the Republicans who've been doing this for a long time are concerned that this is much harder than it looks. Basically, Republicans have a small majority in the Senate. They have probably enough votes to make things go away, but they don't have enough votes to fix them. And that's going to be the difficulty here.
Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, a new genetically modified apple will soon be hitting shelves in the Midwest. It's called the Arctic Apple. It's made by the Canadian company Okanagan Specialty Fruits, and it will be sold pre-sliced. And here's the thing about it. It won't turn brown when exposed to air. The Canadian fruit grower has spent 20 years developing the apple and working to get regulatory approval. And for more, we're joined by Caitlin Dewey, food policy writer at The Washington Post. Caitlin, first tell us how this apple works. How does it not brown?
Well, it's really interesting. They're using a technique called gene silencing. And basically what they're doing is turning off the genes that produce the enzyme that causes an apple to brown when it's exposed to air. So it may brown eventually. It will still produce a little bit of that enzyme, but it'll be totally unlike other apples that, you know, when you slice them, they sort of brown immediately or within a couple minutes.
And the problem with apples browning is what exactly? Because you could still eat them when they're brown.
Yeah, well, a lot of people would argue there's no problem at all, right? But, you know, it is very popular to sell apples pre-sliced in things like Happy Meals, for instance. And those apples have to be treated with things like vitamin C or lemon juice or, you know, various chemicals. So the thought is that these apples won't have to be treated. They'll have to be treated less. They could reduce food waste, that sort of thing.
And is this product thought to be safe?
It is thought to be safe by scientists. Certainly there is a great deal of scientific consensus around the safety of this type of genetically modified produce. That said, a lot of advocates are concerned that there could be harms to the environment, and they say that there's a lot that science doesn't know yet.
And is there a sense that if people like these genetically modified apple slices that don't brown, that it may change their attitudes on genetically modified foods generally?
Yeah, that's definitely what the industry is hoping. You know, right now, GMOs represent a sort of abstract, scary idea to a lot of consumers. And a lot of companies believe that if they can just land the right product that, you know, really shows the consumer benefits of GMOs, that that will lead to a shift in perception and maybe open the door to all kinds of genetically modified vegetables and fruits.
So seedless watermelons didn't do it. but apples that don't brown would do it.
Right, exactly. Well, the seedless watermelon isn't genetically modified. The last fruit or vegetable that was offered to consumers like this was actually a potato that doesn't brown. It's called the innate potato. Hmm. And there was a tomato as well in the 90s that didn't do so well. But they're hoping the apple will be the big winner.
Are there other similar fruits on the way?
Yeah, you know, the FDA just approved a pink pineapple. It has been engineered to have greater health impacts, better sort of like chemicals and nutrients in it than your standard pineapple does. There are also a team of researchers in the UK who have developed a purple tomato. It has some of the antioxidant properties of blueberries, except in tomato form. And there's really no telling what else these companies will come up with if they see that there's a market for these products.
And there are probably some people listening to this saying, why are scientists working on this? Is this really the biggest problem in the world of food, is to get apples to not brown so that consumers are more likely to eat them?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, essentially, something like the apple, you know, it's pretty nakedly a marketing ploy, right? It's an attempt to expand a market that has been stagnant for a long time. But GMO technology, advocates at least say, could have very profound impacts on things like agricultural yields and the ability of farmers to grow crops in certain types of difficult climates and things like that. So in that regard, this technology is actually pretty important.
And these apples will still go bad at some point, right?
They will, yeah. This isn't like the Twinkie apple that lasts for 20 years or something. They just won't go brown. And in fact, they might brown a little bit, just certainly not to the degree of a standard apple you'd get today.
That's Caitlin Dewey, a food policy writer at The Washington Post. Caitlin, thanks.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original Before You Go Toilet Spray, that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
The Super Bowl is less than 2 weeks away, and companies are buying up ad space. This year, Pepsi will have its first Super Bowl ad for bottled water, a product called Life Water. And this comes after bottled water sales beat out soda sales by volume for the first time in 2016. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is Life Water, and is it different from Pepsi's other water brand, Aquafina?
Oh, Pepsi would tell you it's very different. Life Water is purified by reverse osmosis. I'm not sure of all the particulars of that, what makes that so special. But Pepsi also says that it's pH balanced with electrolytes. Everyone loves electrolytes, and those are added for taste. And, you know, the most distinctive feature of this new product is its packaging. You know, it's going to feature these textured labels by emerging artists, people like street artists. There's a guy named Momo who's going to be one of them, and they're going to introduce new designs every few weeks. And Pepsi's hoping that by having these revolving designs, you're going to get young people sharing the images of the bottles on social media.
But it's not like coconut water or some sort of flavored water. This is just water, but luxury water.
Don't just say just water. Okay. It's never just water. Never. No, it's got, as I said, some features to it. It has a little taste to it. I mean, I don't know if you've tasted all the different bottled waters out there, but if you become a connoisseur, then, I mean, you can develop a refined palate for knowing the difference between these various brands that are out there.
Well, and what are the brands? What are the products that Pepsi is going to be competing with Life Water?
Okay, so the market leader right now is Nestle. They make the number 3 and 4 brands. They've got Pure Life and Poland Spring, but their big competitor for Pepsi, their perennial competitor, is Coke. They've got the top spot in the premium water segment. They've got 44% of the market share. And they're not actually buying Super Bowl ads. My reporter, my colleague Jennifer Maloney reports that, you know, they don't have ad buying plans for Dasani or Smartwater. They're two top brands. They may have some campaigns in the next few months, but maybe they feel secure in their water dominance.
Well, and how important is water at this point for these companies? Because as we said, bottled water sales have just beat out soda sales by volume for the first time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And sales of bottled water have surged more than 50% over the last decade, and U.S. soda volumes have fallen over the same period. So it's a bit of a if you look at the chart, it's like a zero-sum game when it comes to water and soda. We're drinking more water, drinking less soda, apparently.
And, of course, not everybody has the benefit that you do, Jason, by being in New York City, where the tap water is very good. But, of course, for many people, it is the case that you could just have some good old-fashioned tap water.
Yes. I mean, if you live in certain parts of Michigan, then you may certainly need some of these bottled watered options. But, you know, it's really it's funny that the companies like Coke, bottled water was a surprise hit to them. They've got more than $1 billion in retail sales last year that they weren't expecting.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The organizers of last Saturday's astonishingly large Global Women's March also had an event Sunday in D.C., 500 women trained to run for political office. They have a 10 Actions, 100 Days program, this week's action, writing postcards to senators. And today, organizers meet about going forward. But will they take up the issue of race? It's called intersectionality, a word coined by a civil rights activist in the late 1980s, to describe related systems of oppression. For instance, white and black women could recognize their same issues. But social media wasn't having it. White women were being attacked for being privileged. A popular poem by Johnetta Elzey asked, "Where were you when your ancestors set out to steal my ancestors from our homes?" It's a wound that may take a while to heal. Ijoma Oluwo is editor-at-large for the media site The Establishment. She's here by Skype. And Ijoma, you're in Seattle. You are black. Didn't walk. Why?
You know, I thought about it. I gave it a lot of thought. And honestly, emotionally, it was really too hard. As the day became nearer and I saw a lot of people who have never marched before, who had never marched with me before and with other people of color before, so excited to march for the first time, it became a really conflicting and emotional time, and it honestly wasn't something I could handle.
Well, you've written a piece describing your thoughts after you watched the marches. Now, first of all, what was it like watching the marches?
You know, it was a mix. It was wonderful to know that so many people were taking to the streets and were speaking out. But if you are a person of color who has been fighting for black lives and brown lives, if you are a water protector who has been hosed down in Standing Rock, you have been begging people to stand next to you for so long. And so it can be hard to look at it and not wonder how many lives could be saved if we had even a tenth of these many people showing up at a Black Lives Matter march to push for police accountability and to push for reform. And that becomes hard because you can't bring people back from beyond the grave.
Well, you titled your piece, "When You Brag That the Women's Marches Were Nonviolent," because people were proud of that. I mean, millions of women and not one arrest was one of the cries afterwards. Could you sum up your thoughts at the end of this piece? You know, is it the thought that you could march a million white women down the street without fear?
You know, my thoughts when I was writing this piece was I was really hoping people could see what the language around the self-congratulatory tone really meant, and, you know, the effects that that could have on people of color. When you look at how marches are described, this march was described completely differently than many other very peaceful marches for Black lives. And when you look at how we are described as thugs when we take to the street, we are described as, you know, disruptors and lawbreakers when we take to the street, and people are pulled off the street not doing anything violent and arrested, to brag that no one was arrested in a march, you know, that was filled with white women as if that is an accomplishment that you really had a huge part of. What it does is then it says that marches that were branded as disruptive are less than. And the truth is we are all fighting for very important things, but only certain people get to march down the street and not have to worry about violence from police officers.
Look, you are not alone. There are other critics saying, and for instance, here's LaRonda Magano Bryant at Williams College, a professor who didn't join the march, saying, you know, the sense of betrayal white women have expressed in the post-election season is disingenuous. Since we can't say enough about the ways they turned out at the polls, I mean, 53% of married white women did vote for Donald Trump. But then you have people like Gloria Steinem saying she and other leaders in the women's movement are devoted to figuring this racial divide out. Immediately after the first social media posts came up, the original women who had the idea, white women, brought in veteran non-white activists, Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, Carmen Perez. They turned it over to others. They were very clear that they wanted to address some of these issues to the extent that others, there's sort of now a backlash to the reaction to the initial backlash. Others like Emma Kate Simmons have written that the agenda for the Women's March was hijacked, and now organizers are bent on highlighting differences instead of talking about the way we are all the same, and we lose when that happens. What about that thought that instead of, as she writes in a New York Times op-ed, all this nasty tit-for-tat between white versus black, queer, Muslim, trans, and other identities, it divides the state of feminism instead of highlighting our commonalities, our need for childcare, health care?
You know, I think it's interesting when people say this, because what we have to ask is, what is really dividing? Because when you say that it is divisive, are the differences divisive, or is it voicing the differences that's divisive? So either you want women of color, trans women, disabled women, queer women to just be quiet and never state what they need in the name of unity, or you want to address it and show that, yes, when you say you are here for women, you are here for all women. So if you want to move women forward, you have to ask, what is holding you back? What is hurting you? I care about you. There's nothing more unifying than reaching out to people and saying, what do you mean?
But this was exactly what Gloria Steinem and other women are saying they intend to do. And we met women of color who went to the march specifically because they wanted to have their voices heard. Here's Raven Stubbs, a student at Harvard, who traveled to D.C. with a busload of Harvard students and alumni.
And I think it was very important for me, one being geographically, you can locate me as a woman of color, and I deserve to take up that space. I deserve to be included in women. When you say Women's March, that has to include me. So I decided to get on the bus to take up space, physically and mentally.
Ijoma, if you feel your issues are being sidelined, why not get off the sideline?
Well, and I think that that's part of what we are doing, and we are speaking out in different ways, right? I've been very vocal about issues that I think need to be addressed, and a lot of other women have been as well. But I think that if we want to move forward, we can't just say we're here now, let's forget the past, because we have to understand how we got here. Mm. We have to understand who's been left behind and why, if we don't want to continue to do that in the future. And when we look at this march, it was a beautiful thing. But we also have, you know, a lot of disabled women who felt really left out. They were barely mentioned in the platform. And accessibility-wise, many couldn't even show up. A lot of trans women were harmed by the language used in a lot of this. And a lot of women of color felt very hurt as well. This does not mean that the march was bad, but it means that if you really do mean what you say, that you want to move forward intersectionally with all women, that you're going to investigate and say, okay, where could we have done better?
Well, and you are reflecting a very deep history here. Gloria Steinem writes about this as well. Yes, in the early suffragette movement, there were racist white women who only wanted the vote for white women to offset the vote that had been given to black men. And then there was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, though, who stood against that and said, no, we want the vote for all women. So this debate, this unease goes back a long time. But I just want to comment on one thing you said. You said you saw women, white women, who hadn't marched before. How do you know? Because some of us looked out and saw, you know, beautiful gray-haired white women who did march for civil rights in the 60s, who marched even before that. So, you know, maybe both sides of this have to maybe let down their perceptions a tiny bit.
I think that a lot of women who had come out before, but I also know that I didn't see a lot of these people at any Black Lives Matter marches. I've been there. I've been looking around.
Yeah.
And when you see people you've known your entire life who speak up online, who say, oh, this is so bad, this is so awful, we're so upset that there's another video of a Black man or a Black woman being killed in the street, but they can't come out and march for you. And then to see them so excited, buying plane tickets, you know, knitting hats, doing all these things, getting ready to get out and march in the street. And you're wondering, where was that need to get out and say something when we were being shot? I am seeing many dozens of members of my community who I have not seen at a single march turn up. And it doesn't mean that they shouldn't turn up at this march. But I do think that if we want to understand why things got the way they are, you do have to investigate. Why now? Why was this, you know, too far? Why was this the final straw? Why wasn't the final straw watching Tamir Rice being shot? That's what I think people need to ask themselves. Because if we want to move forward and not do this again, if we want to not get complacent again, we have to understand where we've been complacent in the past.
That's Ijeoma Oluo, editor-at-large for The Establishment, a media site. Ijeoma, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Academy Award nominations were announced today, and the musical La La Land led the way with 14, including Best Picture, followed by Arrival and Moonlight with 8 each. Joining us now from L.A. to go through some of the nominees is Claudia Puig, president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Welcome.
Thank you.
So La La Land, the big story here, 14 nominations. It ties with Titanic and All About Eve for the most Oscar nominations for a film. We've also got in the Best Picture category Arrival, Fences, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, Hacksaw Ridge, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. Gosh, I remember when there were only 5. But do you think any of those other films can challenge La La Land, which did so well at the Golden Globes?
I think the one that could challenge it would be Moonlight. Given that the Academy voters were slightly more aware of diversity this year than in the previous Oscar so white years, this kind of could be remembered as a year the Academy finally got woke. I think, you know, maybe they will be conscious of that and could go to Moonlight. We do have one of the most diverse slates that we've had in quite a long time. In the category of supporting actress, for instance, the majority of nominees are African-American women.
A lot of people who have seen La La Land, and myself included, wonder if it's really that great or if it's just because Hollywood loves movies about Hollywood.
I see your point. I personally really enjoyed it, but after seeing it a couple more, you know, I've seen it, I think, maybe 3 times now. And the first time I was charmed, and the second time I started to see some of the complaints that people have and some of the flaws. But I think, yes, Hollywood loves movies about Hollywood. Hollywood loves movies about strivers and dreamers and all the things that that's about. And then, of course, L.A. And I think they also kind of have this nostalgia for the classic days of Hollywood.
Well, let's talk about the Best Actor category. Denzel Washington was nominated for Fences. He plays a former Negro League baseball player turned garbage man in 1950s Pittsburgh. Here's a scene of him telling a story about when he first met his wife.
When I first met this woman, I got out that place, said, hitch up my pony, saddle up my mare. There's a woman out there for me somewhere. I looked at here, looked at there, saw Rose, and I latched on to her.
And the other nominees include Casey Affleck playing a grief-stricken janitor in Manchester by the Sea, Andrew Garfield's conscientious objector in Hacksaw Ridge, of course, Ryan Gosling in La La Land, and Viggo Mortensen, an unconventional patriarch in Captain Fantastic. Who's the frontrunner?
I think it's Casey Affleck from everything that we've been hearing up until now. I think Denzel Washington does have a good chance, and he was left out of the directing nominees, and so that may play a part. Ryan Gosling's in there as well, so I would say I'd say basically it's a race between Casey Affleck and Ryan Gosling, with a possible surprise win by Denzel.
In the Best Actress category, we've got Meryl Streep picking up her 20th Oscar nomination, playing the famously off-key soprano Florence Foster Jenkins, Emma Stone playing an aspiring actress in La La Land, Natalie Portman in Jackie as the former First Lady, Jackie Kennedy. Here's a scene from that film. She's talking to one of LBJ's staffers about how she'll continue on with her plans for her husband's funeral procession despite her guests' security concerns.
Inform them that I will walk with Jack tomorrow, alone if necessary. And tell General de Gaulle that if he wishes to ride in an armored car or in a tank for that matter, I won't blame him. And I'm sure the tens of millions of people watching won't either.
The other nominees for this category are Isabelle Huppert as a rape survivor in Elle and Ruth Negga for Loving. She plays one half of the couple whose Supreme Court case struck down the ban against interracial marriage. Who's a favorite in this category?
This one seems more wide open to me. I mean, if we go with the La La Land juggernaut, we would say Emma Stone. I don't think Meryl Streep's going to get it this year. She is beloved, but of course, you know, she's won before and she will win again probably. I think it's a pretty wide open race. I think Natalie Portman might be in the lead.
Hmm. Now, there is so much great television these days that I actually find it hard to convince myself to go and see something on the big screen as often as I used to because I'm watching so much on the small screen. But if there's one film that got nominated this year that you would say everybody's got to see this, what would it be?
Moonlight.
Moonlight.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the one film I tell everybody. If you don't see anything else, see Moonlight. But the performances are beautiful. The cinematography is gorgeous. The score is just impeccable. The writing, the direction, everything about it is just – I just think it's a near-perfect movie.
Well, Claudia Puig, president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be watching the Oscars being awarded on February 26th. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Here's to the ones who dream. Foolish as they may seem, here's to the hearts that ache.
Oh, La La Land, you're going to be hearing a lot about that over the coming weeks. And one thing we didn't talk about was the documentary category. Life Animated did get nominated. That's Ron Suskind's documentary. And that ESPN OJ documentary, many hours long, but it got nominated as well.
Go see Jeremy's interview with Ron Suskind at HereNow.org.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.